Well, I am really, really excited to be with you. I really like Josh, and so therefore you're already one step ahead in my book, so good for you, so don't ruin it. But I really like the topic we're talking about too, and that wasn't always the case, and I imagine some of you were probably like me, or are like I was. I remember I went to a master's university, and I grew up in a faithful Bible-teaching home, but I also kind of just absorbed an attitude, and that attitude you might be familiar with. It's Jesus has come, he has given us instruction in the New Testament through the apostles, and we all know that the words of Jesus aren't read in some of our Bibles, and read means better than the rest of the words. No, that's not, that's wrong, but that's what we think sometimes. And so I kind of had this idea going into college, and I remember sitting in one of my Old Testament survey classes, and I guess if you were to ask me my summary of how I was treating the Bible, I would say, well, my big application of the Old Testament is I'm glad I don't live during that time. That would be my big application. And now I'm glad we have the New Testament. You know, let's live under grace. But I remember the Bible teacher, you know, just opening my eyes to Old Testament survey. It became my favorite class. I didn't really enjoy school, all things considered, but I loved my Bible classes, and especially that class. And my big takeaway from day one of that class was, who do you think that the New Testament was written to? I thought about it for a little bit, and I quickly realized that the New Testament was written to people who knew their Old Testament. It wasn't something that they could just ignore, right? In fact, when Paul is instructing Timothy and talking about how he had been raised on the Scriptures from his youth, he's talking about the Old Testament. And so I quickly repented in dust and ashes, understanding that I really needed to start investigating the Old Testament. And that launched me personally on a quest that continues to this day, but has involved getting my THM and PhD in Old Testament studies, just because I realized that in order to understand the Bible holistically better, even in order to understand the New Testament better, I really needed to know the Old Testament. And now looking back, obviously, the story isn't over yet, but I can tell you that each avenue of understanding that we glean from the Old Testament, it helps us tremendously in the holistic part of understanding God's Word. And I think for most Christians, the law in particular is just where we really, really falter. And, okay, I'm not going to ask for a raise of hands, but I think some of you would identify with me in, you know, making up your mind, I'm going to read through the Bible this year. Genesis, piece of cake. Exodus, for the most part, exciting, fun. That tabernacle instruction, kind of weird, but you got past there. Then you hit Leviticus, and you don't get out. It's just really hard to go through Leviticus, and it just doesn't make sense. It's so different. It's a different way of thinking. And it is a different way of thinking. That's part of the issue, is that we live in a Western culture, and we need to contextualize a lot of this. And so that's kind of the goal this week, is to teach us some of the context of Old Testament law, and then most importantly, how we can apply it today, so that when you go through Leviticus, Lord willing, next time you do that read through the Bible in a year thing, you don't get to Leviticus and you say, oh, I want to jump ship because I have no idea what to do here. The goal would be to teach us a pattern for how we can actually glean understanding. So that's what we're going to do, and we've kind of divided it up into some sessions. Then, like Josh mentioned, we are going to have a Q&A. It's not because I know everything, but hopefully we can glean, by some of the questions that you have for clarification, we can glean some further helpfulness if you don't stump me on every question, which is entirely possible. But we'll give it a whirl anyway. All right, so to start off, let's get started here. And just so you know, the way we're going to run this, obviously, is it's primarily lecture kind of teaching opportunity. It's not a sermon per se. Like, application is going to be light early on because there's a lot of material and information. There will be application later on, but there's a lot of introductory data that we need in order to make the decisions. You can't make decisions unless you understand. So the first question is, how does the Old Testament use the term law? And this is a very basic question. But if you don't get this right, then you're just lost at hand. So even if somebody were to ask you, how should the Christian understand and apply the law today? The question you need to understand too is, what do they mean by law? Because there are actually a few different ways the Bible uses law. So the word law itself comes from the Hebrew word Torah. Maybe you've heard it pronounced Torah, but in Hebrew, the emphasis is on the last syllable, Torah. And it comes from the Hebrew verb yara, which means to throw something or to cast or to hurl. And so basically, in the Hebrew mindset, teaching something is literally throwing it at the students and then they absorb it or whatever. And so law, we often translate it as law, but it really just means teaching. In fact, this term is utilized periodically as a term for teaching. In fact, where'd you guys get to in Proverbs 3? Or, okay, so look, Proverbs 3:1, this is, so you just covered this, it's fresh on your mind. So, my son, do not forget my teaching. Now, it could be translated law there, but the point is, this is the instruction that's being given, right? And that's the emphasis. And throughout the Bible, there are places where Torah, the word for law, is used not as a reference to the body of Mosaic literature, but it's just used for teaching. Okay, there are places like that. There's some in Exodus as well, not just wisdom literature. Now, I will say, though, even though there are other uses, the primary use of the term Torah, which we translate law, would apply to the commandments and requirements that are a part of what we often refer to as the Mosaic Covenant, or sometimes called the Sinaitic Covenant. We'll talk a lot more about that, don't worry. But basically, the Mosaic Covenant is the covenant God makes with Israel when they're at Mount Sinai. Okay? So, usually, the majority of the time, when the Bible is referring to the law, or I should say the Old Testament is referring to the law, it's referring to that covenant that God made and the requirements that are a part of that. Okay, we're going to talk more about that in a little bit. Now, when we look to the New Testament, this is also important. How does the New Testament use the term law? Now, the Greek word for law is nomos, and that's the word that's most often used to translate this concept of Torah in the Old Testament. And some New Testament texts use law to refer to the Pentateuch, so the first five books of the law, right? And that would be in contrast to the prophets, or sometimes also call an additional third category would be thrown out sometimes, the writings, right? So you have the law, the prophets, and the writings is often the three collections that the Jewish understanding would have of the Old Testament. So sometimes the law is used to refer to that first primary section of Scripture. Additionally, some New Testament texts use law to refer broadly to the Old Testament. That's something that we don't think about a lot of times, but you have John 10:34, where Jesus says, does not the law say, I said, you are gods? Because they're getting after him for claiming to be the Son of God, and so he quotes Psalm 82, but then he calls it the law. But that's not technically correct if the law only refers to the Pentateuch, because he's quoting Psalms. 1 Corinthians 14:21 is very similar. There, Paul quotes Isaiah 28 and calls it the law. I mean, are they failing Awana? No, I don't think we want to say that. I think that they understand what they're doing. We just sometimes don't categorize things the same way that they did. And so we need to be specific and exact in assessing these details. Now, it's one of the unique things that you don't really find as much in the Old Testament is that Paul sometimes refers to law as a generic principle. So in Romans 7, it's the famous passage where, you know, the things that I don't want to do, I do, and the things that I do want to do, I don't do. So Paul is having this angst within, this battle within, and he talks about the law that's operative in his flesh, the general principle that's operating in his body. And so he's not talking about the Mosaic law there, or even God's law. He's just talking about a general rule that's operating in his body. Okay? So, now that's rare. It's not that he does that a lot, but he does do it periodically. But by far and away, similar to the Old Testament, the majority of the uses of law in the New Testament are a reference to the Mosaic covenant stipulations. Okay? Now, I go through all this just to be specific, because sometimes in debates within Christendom, there are debates sometimes about, well, how should we apply the law? And right out of the gate, a lot of people they stumble and fall flat on their face because they're not actually talking about the same definitions of law. Okay? So our purpose is going to be talking specifically about the Mosaic law this weekend. This is our primary focus, is how are we to deal with Leviticus? I think it's okay as Christians to talk generically about a law that God has, right? About what he wants. But that is actually biblically distinct from how the Bible talks about the Mosaic law. Okay? So we just want to be very specific. So we define our terms. And part of the reason for this, I may get in trouble with some of you for that, but it's okay. Is it okay? I mean, I might not show up tomorrow again. I don't know, actually. I could get in huge trouble for this. I'm going to say something that may be offensive at first, but that's part of the challenge here, is that you don't know me very well. I don't know you. We're just getting to know each other. It's like a first date. And so I don't know how this is going to go. But I'm going to say some things that if you've been raised in certain circles, you'll be like, wait a second, no. That's heretical that you would say this. So what I'm going to say is that in many churches, they talk about making law-gospel distinctions. And I'll say even people in my church where I go in North Carolina would still use this. Okay? Now, here's why I have a problem of making law-gospel distinctions as we're going to develop this whole weekend, okay? Is that it's in my opinion, and I'll try to present evidence for this, and you can disagree with me, that's fine, but in my opinion, it's actually impossible to make a clear distinction between law and gospel, since gospel is bound with the law, and the law is bound with the gospel. And you look at some verses, and there was this guy on Twitter the other day, and you should stay off Twitter, it's bad for your health, but I was on Twitter the other day, and this individual kept posting verses saying, is this law or gospel? And like all of his followers were voting on whether it was law or gospel. And I kept thinking to myself, yes, 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 yes. You can't define it as law or gospel. It's one of those miscategorizations to think in those two categories. And I know if you've thought in those categories before in your past, you might be thinking, oh man, like this person's crazy. It'll make more sense as we go on. But I'm just saying the reason it's important to define our terms with what the law is, the Mosaic law, is because the Mosaic law isn't antithetical to the gospel. It's actually a part of the progressive revelation leading up to that. And that's part of our theme tonight, is talking about the law as part of God's story. That's a lot of things we don't think in those terms, but we have to do that. So when we think of this, we're going to be using law primarily as just a reference to those stipulations, those regulations within the Mosaic covenant. Okay? That's going to be how the Bible uses it primarily. That's going to be what we're going to do. All right? So these are some of the questions we're going to consider. If you think, okay, what are we going to be doing then? Like, what's the point? What's the point of this weekend even doing these things? Well, we're going to be asking these kinds of questions to help clarify these things. When did God give the law? Believe it or not, that's actually a very important question. It has a lot of ramifications for how you interpret the law. When did God give the law? The Bible's pretty clear about that. To whom did God give the law? That is also very important. Why did God give the law? That's probably even the most important. Okay, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about that tonight. And then how do we relate to the law? Okay, all those are very important questions, but this is where we need to be very careful in how we think, because if we mess up one of these questions, for example, if we mess up to whom did God give the law, you're actually going to mess up why God gave the law and how we relate to the law. Okay? So these are very important historical questions which the Bible gives very clear answers to. All right. So this is a very important starting point. When did God give the law? So here's just a brief outline of the story, the initial part of the story of redemption. And you're probably very familiar with this, but I don't like to leave anything to chance. And so I really want to like clarify this, is that God creates the world in perfection. We all know that, Genesis 1 and 2. God creates the world in perfection. It is literally paradise. That's what the Greek word of the Hebrew Bible uses. And so paradise is created, but man falls in Genesis 3. Now, God doesn't just say, sorry, this is the end of the story, the credits roll, anything like that. In Genesis 3:15, God gives a promise of an individual who's going to come and strike the serpent on the head. And the implication of that great conflict is that God will restore what was broken in the fall. And then that gets fleshed out further later on in Genesis 12. God chooses Abraham, the individual. At that time, he's named Abram, later called Abraham in Genesis 17. But he names Abraham as the recipient of his special promises. And as such, he promises Abraham land. He promises Abraham blessing. And not just Abraham, but the entire, in fact, in Genesis 12:3, it says, in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. So there's a blessing that's going to be funneled to Abraham's family, but it's also going to have this massive splash effect to the entire world, okay? And then so you have land, you have blessing, and then you also have offspring being promised to Abraham, okay? So these three, land, seed, blessing, those three encapsulate the very core of the Abrahamic covenant. And so God initiates that in Genesis 12. And then all the way through Genesis 22, you have the solidification of that covenant. You have it demonstrated in a variety of ways. God takes care of Abraham. He gives him a descendant. He promises that he will continue to make his descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. So God chooses a nation through which he's going to affect blessing on the rest of the world. Now, this is very important to recognize the God's choosing of Israel, because as Deuteronomy tells us, it wasn't because Israel was more mighty or Israel had more people than anybody else. It wasn't because Israel had anything special going for them. It was simply God's gracious choice that he would use that nation. All right? Now, what makes this so important is that God brings Israel down to Egypt for what I call incubator time, okay? I have never used a real incubator in my life, but how I am told it works is you put the egg in the incubator, it stays there for a little while, it keeps the egg warm, and then eventually the egg hatches, and then you have a chicken or a duck or whatever else comes from the egg, an ostrich for all I know. But you have this incubator status, which, you know, allows the egg to be protected and warmed and develop. And that's what Israel's time in Egypt functions as. If they would have stayed in Canaan, it's most likely they would have just assimilated into the Canaanites. Genesis 38 shows an illustration of that, because Judah intermarries with the Canaanites. And then so God sends them to Egypt because they need to be separated from that. So they go down to Egypt, where the Egyptians hate associating with Semitic peoples. And remember in the story of Joseph and his brothers eat separately because it was an abomination for the Egyptians to eat with the Israelites. So they are in their incubator status in Egypt, but then they become oppressed by the Egyptians, right? And so God delivers them. And if you remember the story, you'll know why. God delivered Israel because of the promise that he made to them, because they were his people. And so as God delivers Israel, He does so in a mighty way. And this is after all that background, if you zoned out, zone back in for just a second, because this is the key. This is what I was trying to get to the entire time, okay? God delivers his people, Israel, and then he gives them law. Now, that's going to be very important for multiple reasons. But primarily what we will, and that's what the whole point of this chart is, but just to give you a little taste of what we're going to talk about, is that God's relationship with Israel was prior to law. Okay? In fact, this is what the rabbis always taught. This is what, you know, the majority of scholars teach today. I mean, there are some outliers, of course, but most Old Testament scholars recognize that the law is intended as a gift to a nation that already exists, not as like the start of a relationship, but the continuation of a relationship. Okay? And so that's what we're looking at here with the question, when did God give the law? He gave it at Mount Sinai. And if you think about when God chose Abraham, I mean, basically we're talking about 450, maybe 500 years prior to the giving of the law, God formed a relationship with Abraham in the Abrahamic covenant. I mean, how long has the United States been in existence? I mean, a little more than half of that, right? So that's quite a long time, right? So the law itself is independent of that relationship. It's not tied to that relationship. Now, periodically, I scatter quotes in here. I think they're very boring to read them to you. I'm not going to necessarily read them all to you, but I include quotes periodically just in case as I'm looking around and I'm looking at your faces. I look for any kind of sense where I get the feeling that person has no idea what they're talking about, like you talking about me. Just be like, Peter has no idea what he's talking about. I scattered in there just because some people are all about, backing yourself up with other external authorities. So I concluded, just in case I need to convince you, just in case I'm saying I'm not crazy, there are lots of other people that believe these things. So I include Sprinkle's quote in there. This is Joe Sprinkle in his law, Biblical Law and Its Relevance. He talks about how, and this is just one quote of his work where he talks about how when we think about the law, we need to remember it's given in the context of narrative. It's not just a standalone. And that's, as a big takeaway, that's often where we fail in reading our Bibles, is that we take our Bibles and we do the whole, okay, time for me to read Leviticus. And you just drop in Leviticus and you're just like, I don't know what's going on, but I'll just see you. In order to understand Leviticus, I'm teaching through Leviticus right now at our church, and the church has not died yet. So I'm teaching through Leviticus, and one of the things we've been stressing over and over and over, that Leviticus comes with the understanding that you know what happened in Genesis and Exodus. Okay? And where this is really important is that, I'm going to go to this slide in just a second, but something just popped in my mind that you need to know. Think about how Exodus ends. Okay? They just build the tabernacle, which is an interesting study in and of itself, because that's basically just a one-time set of instructions. It's not really law. It kind of is, but it's one-time instructions. So they build the tabernacle, and what happens is they complete it. Moses is there to help dedicate it. The glory of the Lord fills the tabernacle. This is Exodus 40, the last few verses, and it says, and Moses was unable to enter the tabernacle because the glory of the Lord had settled there. And then Exodus ends. And you're like, well, that's a downer. We just built this tabernacle. Nobody can go in. Whoops. And that's the whole point is that Israel's at a crucial juncture in their existence right now where God says, I'm going to dwell with you. I'm going to make my personal dwelling, my physical location with you. It's going to be represented by the tabernacle existing in your midst. But you need to understand, I am so holy. And so there are going to be tremendous ramifications. And so basically Exodus ends raising the question, saying, how can a holy God dwell with a sinful people? Right? How is that possible? And so Leviticus comes on the scene saying, I have the answer. And then law comes. But you would never get that if you just dropped into Leviticus, like parachuting, bungee jumping in or whatever, and saying like, oh, this looks all strange here, and then getting out. But you need to know it comes on the heels of Exodus. See, law, as revealed in the Pentateuch, both in its Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy portions, is smack dab in the middle of a story. And so when we observe that story, which I kind of summarized on the last couple slides, when we observe where Israel's at, we understand the significance of law. Because, yes, Israel did have a relationship with God in the past, and God had already saved Israel out of Egypt. But now something is different. There's a new phase. There's a new phase in the story. And that new phase is that God is literally going to make his tent in the middle of the nation. And that's going to carry with it drastic consequences. Because when the other nations look at Israel, the other nations are not allowed to just think, oh, it doesn't matter if God dwells with them. They are not allowed to think that. They must think there is a tremendous price to pay if a holy God dwells in your midst. And there is. And that comes in the form of death, comes in the form of sacrifice, in laws of cleanliness, all of that. And so there's a tremendous price to pay. So with that in mind, a couple observations to make when we think about the law coming in a narrative. So first thing that we would observe, I am so adamant about this because sometimes we get this wrong, is that the law is not and was never a means of salvation. Okay? And remember the sequence that I told you is God first saves Israel out of Egypt and then gives them the law. The law was not a requirement for salvation. The law was, it wasn't as if God said, do this law, then I will save you. No. The law was God's gift to Israel after he had already saved them out of Egypt, right? So the law is not a means of salvation. And every rabbi, I can't even think of an exception of this, but I'm sure there's some rabbi that is just out there that hasn't you know, had his Wheaties or anything like that. But most rabbis get this right all the time. They're just like, yeah, of course, the law comes after salvation. That is what it's. Sometimes we struggle as Christians and we think, well, the law was a means of salvation in the Old Testament, but we have grace in the New Testament. But nowhere in the Bible is that taught. Nowhere in the Bible is that taught. The law was never intended as a means of salvation. In fact, sometimes people say, well, if somebody could have hypothetically kept the law perfectly, then God would have had to have saved them. No. Nowhere in the law does it say that if you keep this, you will be saved. Nowhere. And so law is not a means of salvation. The narrative framework teaches that. The law itself teaches that. It's not a hypothetical means of salvation. It's a gift. It's a gift to the people. And the reason it's such a gift is because of this next point, is that the law provides an opportunity to learn exactly how holy God is. See, when you're reading a narrative, and I love reading stories, I hope you do too. Stories are God's gift to us. You know, the Bible is a story, but then even just fiction stories are great entertainment. God created us as human beings to enjoy stories. And you learn so much in stories. And when you're reading stories about God in Genesis and Exodus and even some of the sections of Numbers, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, all these things tell us things about God. But there are certain things that you learn in greater detail by seeing a standard. Okay, so it's one thing to see that God is holy in a narrative, you know, to see somebody mess up and so God wipes them out. Okay, I guess God's holy. But how holy is he? Well, the law acts as a literary means by which you and I can really understand exactly how significant that is. So it's one thing to see God say, I am holy, and then move on. But it's another thing to recognize that if you touch a dead body, because of how holy God is, he can't be associated with death. And so you need to undergo a tremendous amount of inconvenient cleansing ritual because God is holy. Now, it's not sin. You didn't sin, but it doesn't matter. God can't be associated with death because he is the God of life. And so you need to go through that process in order, as an Old Testament Israelite, in order to recognize that God's not like us. He is totally different, totally otherly. And so, and by the way, that's as a side note, that's kind of how I would really push the definition of holy. Talking about the holiness of God is really good, but sometimes we just don't know what that means. And I just really think, when you think of God's holiness, just think of his otherness, like the fact that he is not like us. He's different. And so when it says, when he says, be holy as I am holy, he's saying, be different, be set apart from the people that you are with, because I am very different. And so there's a tremendous amount of helpfulness in thinking that way. And the law provides us a way to see that, to really come to grips with the fact that, you know, just, I mean, so many examples come to mind, right? You think about Nadab and Abihu in Leviticus 10. And spoiler alert, we will talk a little bit more about this story later, but they die. They're sons of Aaron, but they die. And what is their crime? According to Leviticus 10, they offered what's sometimes referred to as strange fire, or sometimes it's translated unauthorized fire. The point is, they did something that God didn't prescribe. And commentators are kind of split on what they did, but the one thing that everyone agrees on is God did not tell them to do that. So they just decided to worship God how they wanted, and so God killed them for it. It's like, and I personally find it very disconcerting that in many churches today, that's kind of our approach to God. It's like, oh, that's just my way to worship God. I'm like, you realize he kills people for that in the Old Testament, right? Not sure we want to go down that road of just worshiping God however we want. And so the point is, we see that so much more clearly in the stipulations of law and what he requires. Now, another thing that we observe in understanding that the law is a part of the narrative framework is that the law is inherently a part of the Sinaitic covenant, sometimes called the Mosaic covenant. They're interchangeable. So the law is inherently a part of this covenant God makes at Mount Sinai. Okay? Now, it's given as a help for Israel, because they are to be, according to Exodus 19, a holy nation, a royal priesthood, right? So they're to be a emissary or an ambassador. They have the ambassadorial role to the other nations. And so it's to help them. It's to help them understand how to do that, right? But the thing we need to recognize is, as part of this narrative, Israel's given this law as part of their agreement, as per the Mosaic covenant, to be his people. That's Exodus 24. Just go. That's where the people make the agreement. Moses says, you know, here are the laws, and the people say, that which you have read, that's what we have heard, we will do. And they seal the covenant with blood, right? So the laws that are given are inherently a part of this mediatorial role that Israel has as per the Mosaic Sinaitic covenant. All right. Now that's going to become a very big issue later on, because I don't want to get into it yet, but I'm just going to tell you why this is important. Because, well, are we under the Mosaic covenant today? The answer to that question will influence our understanding of the law then. All right. So now we answer, to whom was the law given? All right. So to whom was the law given? So the law was given to the geopolitical nation of Israel. All right, so the reason I say geopolitical nation of Israel, and there's not really any disagreement on this among scholars, is because sometimes people will make Israel a metaphorical or some figurehead, but it was given to Israel in a real land, in a real place, at a real time. Okay, so Israel was given the law, and it was given to them in a specific context. And this is why I make a big deal about it, though, is that Gentiles, even Gentiles who joined themselves to Israel, were allowed not to follow certain laws. That's usually surprising to some people. But you can just cross-reference the Passover laws, where in the Passover stipulations of Exodus 12, Moses says that if a Gentile wants to observe the Passover, then he needs to first be circumcised, because we can't let anybody who's not circumcised observe Passover. But the implication, I mean, it's obvious, right? The implication of that law means that if a Gentile doesn't want to observe the Passover and he doesn't want to get circumcised, he doesn't have to, right? So there are plenty of laws that were applied to the sojourner, the Gentile in the midst of Israel that had, by the way, even when Israel came out of Egypt, there were lots of Egyptians that joined themselves to Israel and followed them out, because they said, your God is way better than our gods. we don't want to follow you. And so they joined Israel and followed them. And so there were always Gentiles that joined themselves to Israel, but it's a mistake to think that they always did the same thing. There were Gentiles that committed fully and embraced fully Israelite lifestyle. They ceased being Gentiles and they became Israelites. Well, I'll just throw one out there. Maybe you didn't know this, but I personally am convinced that Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, in Joshua and Caleb, they were the two spies that went into Canaan. I think Caleb was originally a Gentile who was grafted into Israel. He was a part of the Judahite clan. He was of the tribe of Judah, but I don't think so originally. I think he was a Gentile, and there's a lot I could say about that, but we don't have time for any of it. So I wrote a blog article on it if you really want to read more about that. But the point is that when a Gentile joined Israel, he was like, when he fully embraced Israel, he was considered a part of Israel. But when you had Gentiles who were sojourners with Israel, and they weren't fully embracing of, you know, circumcision or Passover, that's fine. The law said, you know, you don't need to force Gentiles to do that. And so this is an important distinction. As the law was given to Israel, the Gentiles were not forced to obey the law. The law provides the necessary insight into how Israel must live with a holy God in their midst. Now, I made a big deal about this already, but we need to keep this in our mind, that we're asking and answering the big question of how in the world can Israel exist with a holy God in their midst? That's just not normal. No other nation has ever had that happen before. So if a holy God is dwelling with us, how can we live? How can we survive? That's really the question. How can we survive with a holy God in our midst? And so the law helps give them guidance, helps give them marching orders for how to understand their relationship with God. All right. Now we've been cruising right along on these, but we have a couple more questions to answer here. So why did God give the law? And this is, like I said, this is probably one of the biggest questions we have to answer, because if we've gotten the first ones right so far, this one will be easier. But if you don't get the first ones right, this one's actually really hard to get right. But in light of the law, in light of the narrative that we've traced and how we've seen the law intersect with that story, how should we understand the function of the law? All right, break out your calculators and your pencils and get ready for some... I don't know how a calculator would ever help you, actually. But regardless, the point is this is going to be some important stuff here, okay? So the thing that we need to remember as the law being a part of the narrative is that the law is essential and integral to the covenant God is making with Israel. So that's why I have the heading Law as Covenant Document here. So the reason I have this set up this way is that in the ancient Near East, so other nations... The nice thing is we do have some sources from times that predate and are essentially contemporaneous with the 14th century BC. Now, all this takes place. Israel comes out of the land of Egypt in 1446 BC. All right, that's why you needed your calculator, to punch in 1446. 1446 BC, that's when Israel comes out of Egypt. And then they wander for 40 years in the wilderness, and then they enter 1406 BC into Canaan for the conquest. So they are given this covenant in 1446 BC. And then Deuteronomy is written in 1406 BC as a re-solidification of this. But the reason that's so important is because we have other ancient Near Eastern treaties and covenants from that time period. Okay, we have Hittite law documents, Hittite covenant structures. We have Babylonian covenant structures. We have Sumerian covenant structures. And so we can compare and contrast and see, okay, what's going on in these contracts? What's going on? And what we see is that the law covenant document that we see in Exodus 21 or Exodus 19 through 24, and then the entire book of Deuteronomy mirrors. Now, it doesn't have to be exact, but it parallels the covenant structure that we see in the ancient Near East from that time. The fancy term that they use, you don't have to remember this, you won't be a lesser Christian if you do, but it's usually called a suzerain vassal treaty. I mean, I can't even see that coming on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, so whatever. It's called a suzerain vassal treaty. And basically what they do is you have a suzerain, the sovereign, and he's making a treaty with a lesser individual or an entity or a nation, the vassal, right? You've probably heard of vassal before. And so in these covenant documents, you would have the historical prologue detailing the history of the relationship between the nations, and then you would have a preamble talking about what the relationship is expected to be. Then you'd have general stipulations as to the main guidelines for how a covenant, the covenant is supposed to operate. And then you also have the specific stipulations, which function as specific applications of those general guidelines. And then you have the provisions for reading, the witnesses, and then the blessings and curses. Blessings if you obey the covenant, curses if you disobey. So that's essentially what we see in the Old Testament. And that's not a surprise. God regularly accommodates human beings with where we're at. And so God uses the literary devices of making a contract and covenant that we see in the world functional at that time. And one of the big takeaways of this is that we can then understand how the law functions a little better. Okay? Now, this is Exodus. The same thing happens with Deuteronomy on this. So Deuteronomy, the same kind of outline is there, except in Deuteronomy you have more emphasis on the witnesses and the blessings and curses. I mean, it's just a longer document. But Deuteronomy, I like to call, and this isn't unique with me, but I think Deuteronomy functions very much like Israel's constitution. So when you end up reading the minor prophets or any of the prophets, really, or even the narratives, they basically assume that you know Deuteronomy because that's what's operating in the background, okay? Well, I'll say something here at this point because I don't know if I'll remember to say it later. So Deuteronomy, so especially, this is another motivation to really learn the Old Testament law, is because when you're reading other Old Testament narratives, like let's say you're reading Kings or Samuel or whatever, the assumption of the Old Testament writers, the narrator and the prophet as he's writing down scripture, he doesn't want to repeat everything that's ever been written in the Bible before. I don't know if you kind of get that. I mean, that would be impossible. So he assumes that you know the law. He assumes you know Deuteronomy. So a lot of times, this really comes in like the law of the king, for example, in Deuteronomy 17, as you have the authors of Kings talk about the different kinds of kings that are living during Israel. They just describe them. And then you're supposed to be able to evaluate whether they're good or bad. And then sometimes they'll give an evaluation statement saying, oh, his heart was not holy God's like his father David or whatever. And that's true. But the real indication should be what they're doing in their actions as compared to what the law requires. Okay? Now, that's just an example of what we're talking about, because the law is primarily functioning as a part of this covenant document. Now, I do want to give an illustration of how this works, because I think I really want to be specific on this, because we're going to talk about this in the next tomorrow, is that when we talk about the structure of this and how it portrays the function of the law, it partly depends where you're reading the law. The general stipulations, both in Deuteronomy and Exodus, are equivalent with what we often refer to as the Ten Commandments. In Hebrew, they're referred to as the Ten Words primarily, because the Ten Commandments are not just commandments, they are principles. They are guiding values, okay? This is what it is, okay? In the United States, the Constitution, we're a constitutional republic, the Constitution is what guides our nation, right? It's supposed to. And we have, in order to help us understand how the Constitution works out in everyday life, we have what's known as case law. Case law. So the judicial branch is supposed to take a court case and say, okay, this is how the Constitution is supposed to impact this life, and therefore this is how the court needs to rule. And that's case law. And then the case law is supposed to apply in other people's circles and everyday life. But the Constitution is the general principle. The case law is the specific stipulation or the specific principle, right? So when you read the law, there is actually, we're going to talk more about the holistic unity of the law later. But when you read the law, you need to understand that not all laws are equal. Now I'll talk more about that later. But not all laws are equal. The 10 words are the specific guiding, centralized principles that guide Israelite life, okay? And then the specific stipulations talk about what that should look like from case to case. And it's not exhaustive, though. It's just meant to guide it. But so if we take a step back then, what is the purpose of the law? The purpose of the law, in light of this, is to help Israelite day-by-day life, understanding how to apply general stipulations, God's general expectations. That's an important part of it. So the law clearly highlights the Decalogue, which we call the Ten Commandments, that's another word for it, or the Ten Words, as being prominent. That forms the general stipulations, and then the specific stipulations form the contextual applications of those general stipulations. All right, how are your heads so far? Well, it doesn't matter. I'm going on. Okay. All right. So here's a really important point we're going to come back to later. It'll be interesting to see if we have anybody else come tomorrow. They'll all just stay home sleeping. All right. So the thing to remember here, and this is going to be a really important concept to remember if you ever want to find out how we apply enduring application from the law, is there's an important link between the law and creation, okay? So this was actually a big part of my dissertation, and so that's why I'm super pumped about this kind of thing, but I only have like one slide for it, which is a shame, because I think I wrote 80 pages on it. But alas, you don't want 80 pages. I don't want 80 pages. We'll compromise. One slide. So when you read the Decalogue, when you read the 10 words, you see language that very easily could have just been copy-pasted out of Genesis 1. Maybe some of the easiest examples would be, actually, let's see if I can do this. Oh, that kind of works. Look at that. So if you look at like Exodus, I'm going to bring up the Decalogue here. So in Exodus 20, you have the Ten Commandments, and this is the second one. The first one is, you shall have no other gods before me. The second is, you shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is heaven above or that is on the earth beneath or the water under the earth. Now, if you're thinking that sounds like Genesis 1, you would be correct. That is essentially a copy-paste from Genesis 1 when it's talking about creation. It talks about heaven above, earth beneath, and the water under the earth. Same phrases. And that's intentional because the whole point of this principle, remember, we're talking about the law is more than just do this, don't do that. There's guiding values at core here. What the law is trying to do is trying to teach Israel about how they live, but why? Because part of the function of the law that we'll get into is that it teaches us how to live in God's created order. Okay, so if God creates, by the way, then that's an easy connection to make too, because who created the world? God. Then it makes sense that the application of God's creation would be that you should worship nothing else but God because he's all that there is, right? And then that's the whole point of the second commandment as well, is that that's why you're forbidden from making anything like God. So the first commandment says, you shall have no other gods before me. Don't bring anything else up to God's level, right? That's a creation principle. The second commandment is don't make God like regular creation, right? Don't make images of heaven above or earth beneath or the water under the earth, right? So it's The two commandments, the first two are linked. The first one is don't make anything else like God. Second one is don't make God like anything else. God is special, right? And so the point is, as we're going through this, that as you go through the Ten Commandments, there are very strong creation connections. The Sabbath, obviously that's a big one. You have the reason for keeping the Sabbath is that God created the world in 6 days, and on the seventh day he rested. And so so Israel is to model that for the nations. You have even things like you take adultery. Well, there's lots of them. Every single one connects. You have murder. Why can't you murder? Because we're made in God's image. How do we know we're made in God's image? Because of the creation. All these things. It's all connected, right? So the whole point is that there's very deep connections between the Ten Commandments and creation. Okay? So one of the big takeaways is that the Decalogue provides insight into how we live in light of God's creative design. Okay? Now, so we have two big takeaways so far. So under the heading function of the law, the function of the law was to teach Israel how to understand their relationship to God, right? Then you have the teaching of God's created order, right? And then a third one is the law also functions to maintain a strict geopolitical and ethnic identity. So we see this throughout the law. Exodus 19, 5 and 6 says, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples. In other words, all peoples are not going to be my treasured possession. You will be my treasured possession among all peoples. Okay? There's a distinction between Israel and the nations. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his treasured possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. Again, there's a distinction, right? Leviticus 20, 26. You shall be holy to me, for I am the Lord, for I, the Lord, am holy, and have separated you from the peoples, that you should be mine. So there's this heavy theme in the law that Israel is to be set apart from the peoples, right? They can't be like the other nations. And so what you end up seeing then are laws against intermarriage, laws about clean and unclean foods. Well, how does this work? Deuteronomy 7, 1 to 3, for example, gives laws on forbidding intermarriage between the Canaanites and things like that. And that's not just because God's racist or anything like that. There's a need to keep Israel separate from people that would otherwise be so much like them and then draw them away from Yahweh, which ended up happening anyway because the people just refused to listen to God. But that was the intent of those laws, is to keep Israel a set apart holy nation that wasn't being grafted into the idolatrous nations around them. Same thing I think the primary reason for the clean and unclean foods was to keep a set apart status for Israel, because Israel's diet was so restrictive, they basically couldn't eat with anybody else. And if you can't, it's still the same today. Can you imagine if you could not eat with anybody here? Like, it'd be really hard to associate. We just do so much fellowshipping around food, right? And I guess the easiest example to think about would be, think about people who are gluten intolerant or something like that. It's really hard to, it's not impossible. Thankfully, now we have so much technology and possibilities, but it's really difficult for people to, you know, they have to have their own pizza crust, they have to have their own menu, all these different things, right? And so it's very hard to share food with people. And that's what Israel had to go through all the time with their clean and unclean food distinctions, is that they were set apart. And so then you get to the New Testament and God reverses all that. And we'll talk more about that later. But at this point in the Old Testament, at this point in the narrative, it was important to keep Israel separated from all the other nations so that they could exist as a specific geopolitical ethnic identity, and that they could function as the ambassador for the Lord, that they could be a holy nation on his behalf. I don't know what that is. Was that three? There's some. I should number these. I think that was three. So then here's the fourth, and in my mind, if we're going to go for a primary purpose of the law or a primary function of the law, this is it. All right? So if you care what I think at all, this is what I think is the primary purpose of the law. There are lots of functions of the law, as you can tell. I just gave you three, but I think this would be the primary one. Okay, the purpose of the law according to Paul. So this is Paul's fleshing out of why we have the law. So he says in Romans 5:20, now the law came in to increase the trespass. That's kind of weird. Maybe that was just a typo. Maybe Paul messed up on that one. Later on in Romans 7:7-25, he talks about how the law is holy, righteous, and good, but then as he's talking about it, he says, but because of sin, the law brings about an increase of sin and death. So again, same thing. He exemplifies that there. He says in Romans 3:20, through the law comes knowledge of sin. Galatians 3:19, the law was added because of transgressions. Now, the way I interpret that is not... So some scholars have said, well, the law was added to restrain transgression. So in other words, Israel was sinning, and so God gave them law to kind of keep that under wraps or keep it under control. But that would be an epic failure on behalf of the law, and I don't think that that's what Paul's saying here anyway. I think what he's saying in Galatians 3:19 is what he just said in Romans 5:20, that the law was added because of transgressions, meaning because of the need to increase transgressions would be the idea. And so, okay, I have a couple verses up here now, so let's talk about it. So what would it mean the law came in to increase the trespass, or the law was added because of transgressions? What Paul is saying is that God gave the law to increase sin. In other words, one of the primary functions of the law was to show people how sinful they really were. And so because of the way we are as human beings, because of how sinful we are, because of our hearts being naturally unregenerate, right? When we are told what to do, we naturally rebel against that. It's the craziest thing. Josh told me that there are lots of families with young kids here, and I see a lot of young kids here, so I feel like this point is going to be well taken, especially for you youngsters. Listen to me, because I'm talking to you now. Whenever parents tell kids, like, don't do this, there's, like, something, and it's called sin, that is on the inside, where the kids are like, that's what we're going to do, or that's... this is what we're going to do now. Like, I never in my wildest dreams ever thought about doing that, but because my parents told me not to, we're doing it. You know, it's just like that kind of thing, right? Like my wife and I, we have young kids, 6, 4, and 2. And when we have this conversation quite often, it's like, okay, should we tell our kids not to do this? No, we should just... hope they don't, because as soon as we do tell them, that's going to be another thing that they're going to be like tempted to do, you know? But that's just part of the unavoidable process of parenting as kids get older. But that's part of understanding that, listen, there is something very wrong with us as human beings. And it is called sin. I wasn't joking. Because we are sinners, when we are faced with a standard of what we ought to do, we don't do it. And that's Paul's entire point in Romans 7 is that that's a struggle that everybody goes through, just understanding that we as human beings cannot follow that standard. And so God gives Israel the law, but God knows that in so doing, they are going to break it. God's not foolish. God knows what's going to happen when he gives the law. He knows they're going to break it. He knows that they're going to sin upon sin upon sin, right? And so this is a part of the progress of revelation, though. And as Paul says, I'll go to that quote later. As Paul says later in Galatians, I only have Galatians 3 here, but in Galatians 5, well, Galatians 3 through 5, he makes this really, really important argument. And he says that the law was a tutor. The law functioned in a pedagogical way. This is what we would define the teaching aspect of the law. It was it was there to tutor us, to teach us about our sinfulness, to teach us that we can't keep the law, that the law is not wrong, the law is not broken, but it really reveals our brokenness and our need for a Savior, right? And so Paul makes that huge argument in Galatians saying, listen, like, the law was here to teach us about the need for Christ. And then he goes on, and we'll talk about this tomorrow, but he goes on to say, that's why now that Christ has come, there's a change. There's a change here. And we'll talk more about that tomorrow, obviously. There's a lot to that. But the point then, and this is, again, trying to tell you that I am not my sole authority. There are lots of other people that say these kinds of things. So this is from Tom Schreiner in his book, 40 Questions About the Christian and the Law. He says, the purpose of the law, it seems, is to enclose all under sin and to increase transgression so that all will see that salvation is available only through faith in Christ. So again, it goes back to what we said. The law was never a means of salvation. The law, that makes sense reading the narrative. It was never to save Israel. And here we see in Paul's discussion that the purpose of the law in giving it at the time that he gave it, for the purpose that he gave it, it was to really show how broken we are and how sinful we are and how much we need Christ. And that's a tremendous blessing, even though it's painful, right? It's a painful blessing, but it is a blessing nonetheless. And so when we think of this fourfold purpose of the law, like the function of the law, I think that this is really important to understand, is that as we read Scripture, we see that the law helps Israel understand what God requires as part of being in the covenant with them. It helps us understand God's character, certainly. It also helps us understand how God wants creation to function, God's created design. There are laws connecting to creation, and we'll talk more about that to be sure coming up. And then we also have the law guarding and protecting Israel as a geopolitical nation, keeping them separated from the nations. And then the biggest purpose that I would throw out here for Paul's discussion of the law is that the law comes in to increase transgression and to show us how much we need a Savior. Okay? Now, that does nothing to answer the question of how we use the law, okay? Because maybe you've even heard many of these things, but these are very important foundational thoughts, okay? Now, I do want to throw out just a few more verses which are going to confirm our line of thinking for the purpose of the law, revealing transgression as its primary teaching purpose, right? So in 2 Corinthians 3, 7 through 18, in Paul discussing the difference between the Mosaic covenant and the new covenant, this is such an important passage. You have to be aware of this if you want to understand the relationship between the new covenant and the old covenant. This is Paul's assessment. He says, the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. That's pretty absolute, right? And there, the letter is the old covenant, the law of the old covenant. So the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. Right? Now, some of you might ask, well, what about 1 Timothy 1? Because in 1 Timothy 1, 8 through 11, we see a passage which talks about the purpose of the law. Now, Paul writes, we know that the law is good if one uses it lawfully, understanding this, that the law is not laid down for the just, but for the lawless and disobedient, for the ungodly and sinners. He goes on to list them. Interestingly enough, the list that he gives there loosely is modeled after the Ten Commandments. So the question is, what does Paul mean here? When Paul is talking about this, is it possible that he's saying that the law is to help control sin? It's possible. It certainly is. And that wouldn't contradict anything we've talked about so far. It's definitely possible that Paul is saying there is a usefulness in the law in restraining evil. But I think this is better interpreted in light of Paul's attack on the false teachers that he's addressing in 1 Timothy. And I think he's drawing out the application of the main purpose of the law, revealing sin. So in other words, I think when Paul says, we know that the law is good if one uses it lawfully, the law is not laid down for the just, but for the law's disobedient. In other words, the law exists to show sinners their sinfulness, not to restrain sinners. And I mean, if I get to heaven and Paul says, no, I meant it is to restrain sin as well, I'm not going to be super offended by that. I just think that this matches much better with Paul's other arguments. And so Paul's overall point would be then is that the way God reveals sin to sinners is through law. Maybe some of you have, now, this could be a, all right, I take this for what it's worth, okay? Some of you guys have heard of Ray Comfort or whatever, right? Yeah, the YouTube videos he puts out are really fun to see him talking with unbelievers. He's popularized that way of the master. Now, you can have your issues with that. I mean, I definitely shy away from telling people that they should always evangelize that way, but I also think that there's helpfulness doing it that way sometimes. The main point that I'm trying to draw out is that one of the things that Ray Comfort does in talking with unbelievers is he tries to talk about the Ten Commandments as being, you know, a standard which reveals God's character, and he tries to show them that even though they think they're a good person, because they always answer that way, right? He says, do you think you're a good person? And they always say yes. And then he says, well, can we just ask some questions? Like, have you ever taken the name of the Lord in vain? Have you ever looked at a woman with lust in your heart? You know, he just starts walking. He uses law, right? And there may be some ways that I would say things different than Ray, but at the same time, the principle that's at play there is a good one, where people are being taught that they are sinners, that there's a function of law, but nobody is good, well, at least nobody should with take away from that interaction that, okay, all I need to do is just obey those laws and then I'm a good person, because that's not, you can't. You could make, and in fact, maybe I'll offend lots of you, okay? Maybe I won't be here tomorrow morning, Josh. all right, one of the things that is crazy, I know as Christians, we would prefer a lot of better laws, like laws that coincide with Scripture and things like that. I mean, that would be an ideal preference. But if we understand Scripture correctly, if we had good biblical laws, what would it do to the unbeliever? It would increase their sin, right? I mean, they're not capable of obeying. They're not capable of obeying in the same sense. I mean, this has been proven time and time again. Like, I don't mean to go crazy on, but I was just reading History of the Mafia, which is a weird topic, but I was reading it because I was like, oh, what was it like in, you know, the early 1900s? Let me tell you, it was very wicked. And they had lots of like really biblically sound laws. There's just always been wickedness. Like, we always get in this mindset of thinking like, oh, things were better back then or whatever. But the reality is that unbelievers will increase sin in laws, you know? And so we'll talk more about that later. I just wanted to try to offend people to, you know, make things exciting going into the next couple days there. But I think if we're taking Paul's thought seriously, his theological application seriously, laws will not help unbelievers. Like, as far as like helping them be good people or whatever, like, let me say that I fully acknowledge there is a pragmatic aspect to this, right? But we're talking about a deep theological reality here, okay? Where law does increase sin. Paul himself talks about that, where in Romans 3, I think it is, he says that he would not have known sin as deeply as he did until he came face to face with thou shalt not covet, right? And he comes face to face with that and realizes that, you know, he just can't help but covet that. And so there's this deep aspect of the law. The primary function of the law is to teach people their sinfulness. So let's summarize. Purpose of law given to Israel to teach them how to live in light of the created order within a specific cultural context. Law given to Israel to teach them about the character of God in ways that would not be possible without clear standards. The law was given to manifest or to maintain Israel's geopolitical and ethnic identity while functioning as Israel's constitution. And then the law was given to Israel to increase sin and to teach Israel that they were wicked and needed Christ. I think sometimes we forget that one and we struggle with that one, but that is a primary purpose of law, according to Paul. And we see that in the Old Testament too, just clearly exemplified. And so understanding this, understanding these principles are going to help us as we weed through tomorrow, as we go through and talk about, okay, how, as like on the other side of the cross, as regenerate Christians, how should we view the law? How should we work through this? There's going to be a great discussion on working through the applicability of the law today that we will begin tomorrow morning, which we will do tomorrow. I'll save this for tomorrow morning because I think this will be a good thing to do while we're fresh.